Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1868, Edouard Manet and his wife Suzanne had their portrait painted. The man holding the brush? No one less than Edgar Degas. The two were friends. The Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic Sebastian Smee writes that there is peculiar coolness to the painting. Degas paints Manet in repose. But is Manet experiencing, quote, a marrow-draining lethargy or the bliss of reverie? Well, we don't know. But what we do know is that the painting excited Manet's passions to a destructive degree. Manet later took a knife to Degas' portrait and slashed the canvas straight through the image of his wife's face and body. Now, why would he do that? Why would Manet try to destroy a beautiful portrait made by his close friend Degas? Well, that's the intriguing mystery that launches Sebastian Smee's new book. It's called The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. And Sebastian Smee joins us in the studio. It's good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Meghna. Thank you.
What a compelling book and a very intriguing mystery that got you thinking about this idea of rivalry in modern art. So tell us a little bit more about Degas and Manet. What was going on?
Yeah, it was just a mystery to me. And I'd known about that painting for a long time. I'd never actually seen it except in reproduction. So I actually traveled to Japan and got one of those bullet trains to this sort of sleepy industrial port called Kitakyushu, where they have a sort of old, a kind of sad-looking modernist ruin of a museum, which has only a few really great paintings, and this is one of them. It's not that big, but it has one-third of it missing, and this is the very strange thing. It's just a sort of a blank area of canvas, which is like that because Degas took it back from Manet. He was very upset, obviously, that Manet had destroyed his picture and intended to repaint it, but never got around to it.
But never did.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So it was a mystery to me as to why he'd done that. I knew that Degas and Manet were great friends and were a big influence on each other, and especially Manet on Degas in the 1860s. And so I sort of traced the build-up to this incident through the 1860s, through research and reading more and more about them, and it just became fascinating to me, this dynamic.
Well, so tell us a little bit more then about that build up to that moment, because you write about, and not just for Degas and Manet, but the other rivalries you write about Picasso, Matisse, Pollock and de Kooning, and Freud and Lucien Freud and Francis Bacon. But in each case, you say that one fell under the other's spell.
Yeah.
Now, how
yeah.
did we see that with Degas and Manet?
Right. I mean, that's really the key idea to the book. I mean, the word rivalry is in the title, but I just became fascinated by this much more sort of subtle idea of rivalry, that it was about yielding and influence and what happens when you fall under the spell of someone else. And that's exactly what happened to Degas. You know, he was an incredibly talented artist, but he was kind of stuck. You know, he was the kind of personality who cultivated difficulty, you know, and was always revising things and going over them. And then he met Manet, who was sort of incredibly suave and nonchalant and painted as if it was sort of just a casual afterthought. I mean, that's an exaggeration. He was a wonderfully gifted painter, but this brushy style and this sort of incredible intoxicating fluidity that he had, it was a real contrast. So Degas paid a lot of attention to what he was doing and changed his whole way of working as a result.
Are there any particular specific paintings from Degas that really show that
yeah,
change?
Yeah, you know, what he was painting before he met Degas were these sort of, what everyone else was painting, these recreations of biblical myths and histories, the kinds of official painting that were taught in the academy. Manet was the first painter to come along, as many people know, and sort of paint everyday life. You know, real people in real situations in contemporary Paris. It was the beginning of Impressionism, the beginning of Modernism. And so it was huge. But no one else was doing it at that time. But Degas saw that Manet was doing it and wanted to be a bit more like Manet.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I mean, we can talk a lot about how we see the falling under each other's spell slash rivalry in terms of the actual works they produced. But what do we know about the nature of their friendships or relationships? Like, did they write about each other? Do we have a sense as to what they actually thought about each other as, in this case, as men?
Yeah, in many cases we do, from things that they said and from things that were said by everyone who knew them. Each of these artists has been the subject of sort of massive biographies, yeah, and big shows, and I've been, fortunate to have access to those great books. You know, I think what happened in each case was that you had someone who was not only influenced by artistic breakthroughs, but by a personality that they'd sort of fallen under the spell of. So in each case, you had someone who was kind of charismatic and charming and spontaneous, risk-taking in many cases, certainly in the case of Manet and Francis Bacon. And this had an effect on the other person, who very much felt inferior at first. But then what happens, of course, when you fall under the spell of someone is that you're under pressure to sort of take on that influence and yet to push back, to kind of hang on to your own identity. I think that's something maybe we can all relate to if we sort of feel powerfully affected by someone.
So you mentioned Francis Bacon. Where do we see the pushback in terms of the rivalry between him and Lucian Freud?
Right. So Freud was an artist who was not very well known, except within a few, a small circle. He was a great draftsman, so he could draw beautifully, and that's what he'd got his reputation for up until that point. Then he meets Bacon, who is not actually a very good draftsman at all, but does incredibly bold things with paint, risk-taking. You know, he sort of gets a rag and smears someone's face and talks about images popping into his head like slides in a projector and works so quickly, destroys more than half his paintings, whereas Freud is working on the same thing for weeks and months at a time. And Freud looks at this and he thinks, wow, I think I need a bit more of that. and really does just very slowly change in that direction. He stops drawing. He only paints from that point on. And yet he's also thinking, I can't just copy this guy. I need to assert my own individuality. And, one of the differences that they sort of stuck to was the fact that, Bacon never sort of painted his portraits from people in the same room. He worked from photographs and so on, whereas Freud always worked from people who were in the same room as him and, closely observing them for weeks and months at a time. But he did use paint in a much more sort of sensuous and risky way, following Bacon's example.
I mean, you actually had a chance to talk to Lucian Freud?
Yeah, I was lucky to get to know Freud in London over about 4 years and spent a lot of time with him. And so part of the sort of beginnings of this book was something that I noticed when I first visited his studio in Holland Park in London, just around the corner from his house in Notting Hill. And it was a big poster just outside the door to his studio. It was a big wanted poster in the sort of old-fashioned Western style. And it had a reproduction of a portrait of Bacon that he had done. I recognized the picture. And I also knew that it had been stolen from a gallery in Berlin in the 80s. And Freud was having a retrospective coming up, and he very much wanted that picture back. So the British Council launched a campaign. They offered a reward of 300,000 Deutschmark, I think it was at the time, and put up posters all around Berlin and in other places too. They never got the picture back. It was just a very small painting, but a real key picture, a turning point in his career. And I knew that they'd fallen out, and I was very hesitant about raising the subject of Bacon with Freud. I never brought it up until much later. So I was curious about why he'd have this picture of Bacon right there, the first thing he saw as he walked up to his studio every day. And it was a clue to me that this relationship, it wasn't just about the painting. It was about this relationship that meant so much to him. It was really the key relationship in his career.
Well, why did they have a falling out?
Well, yeah, that's complicated. It involved love life and it involved jealousy. And I think, it's part of the same volatile dynamic that I think Bacon liked to think of Freud as his protege. And then Freud's pictures started getting better and better known, and getting, you know, making more, getting higher and higher prices when they sold. And Freud, who had been completely dependent on Bacon for cash and so on for a long period of his life, was suddenly quite well off. Yeah. And I think Bacon became a little bit jealous.
Well, I ask because I mean, these aren't you know, perfectly placid relationships. I mean, no. In the book, it seems as if much of the book is to make the point that if they were, the great art that the relationships inspired probably may not have happened. I mean, there was a great degree of tension, falling out, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that these rivalries were essential to pushing both artists on both sides of the relationship to the next phase of their career? Or
yeah.
I mean, I guess it's a hypothetical, so
no.
It's hard to answer. But but would we have seen the same level of work had these, you know, had Manet not met Degas, had Matisse
right.
and Picasso not had their friendship, had, you know,
yeah.
Pollock and de Kooning, we haven't even touched on
no,
yet.
No, but I mean, you know, I think there's no question that you know, these were incredibly important relationships, and yes, you know, prompted these breakthroughs. You know, there's no doubt that when Picasso met Matisse, for instance, in the early 1900s in Paris, he was completely thrown off course. He'd never seen someone paint so wildly. He thought he was a sort of wunderkind, and he'd been celebrated as such from a very early age. And then he meets this sort of bespectacled Frenchman who seems to live a very conservative-looking life, painting the most unbelievable things, so audacious, so anarchic and wild. And he's really blown off course. And he's fascinated by Matisse. He's fascinated by Matisse's family life, his way of painting, his whole manner of being. And yet he doesn't want to be anyone's protege. He refuses. I mean, there was just not in Picasso's makeup to be, you know, subordinate to anyone. And so this dynamic plays out. And you're right, it's incredibly volatile. And yet it's intimate, and it's very sort of poignant and moving as well.
Right. So, I mean, using the word intimate, that's a central idea that you bring forth in the book, The Art of Rivalry. I mean, you write that there is, this is your word, Sebastian, I believe an intimacy in art history that the textbooks ignore, and this book is an attempt to reckon with that intimacy.
Right. I felt that way. And I guess what I meant was that, you know, when we study art or when we go to museums, we sort of introduce to the sort of roll call of movements, you know, Fauvism and then Cubism and then Surrealism. And you know, that's just the 20th century. And we're taught to sort of look at breakthroughs in the way pictures work. So Matisse liberates color and Picasso introduces sort of Cubist faceting of form and so on. But what we often forget, because it's awkward to talk about and it can be embarrassing and it can involve speculation, but these personalities, these temperaments had a profound effect on one another, and they helped one another, and they were a threat, they were a challenge. And I really feel that for a few years there, Picasso woke up every morning thinking about Matisse. And I think that the same was true with Freud and Bacon. You know, they had lunch together every day, said Freud's first wife, or second wife, I should say, you know, for a period, a number of years. They were with each other the whole time. And so a lot of great stuff came out of these relationships.
I also note that we haven't answered the question of why Manet took a knife to Degas' canvas.
It was complicated. It was complicated. But we can get to that some other time.
Oh, okay. Let's do that. Well, the new book is The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. It's from Sebastian Smee, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for the Boston Globe. Sebastian, it's always a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. I love being here.
We've got more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.